Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Snell Nation. And I hope everyone is having a lovely, lovely weekend. I'm broadcasting from the beautiful Columbus, Ohio. It's been interesting. The weather has been all over the place. We had some high winds here and there, a little bit of snow, slight little touch of hail, and some sunshine, surprisingly. It actually looks decent. I mean, it's the skies are, you know, it's Ohio. You take what you can get, but no real complaints here. You know, so hey, you're here, so let's talk. And today I was listening to a lot of just back and forth on social media about it's the presidential election / selection cycle. So you have your D's and your R's, your Democrats, your Republicans, and the occasional Libertarian that jumps in here and there, going back and forth on, you know, well, Trump is terrible because of this, and, you know, and Biden is terrible because of this, and, you know, and I think Johnson should run again as a Libertarian, blah, 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 you know, just the same old shenanigans, and, I just sit and listen for the most part, and then I tend to kind of point out the huge flaws in all of their candidates combined with the huge flaws in those major parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, and how, you know, it is my opinion based on my life experience and the data that I've seen that, you know, essentially there's a corporate party and there's only one and the other parties fall underneath that party. And because for some reason, whenever there's something hanging out there that's, you know, being pushed by the special interests or being pushed by the major corporations, sometimes it takes a little time, but they tend to get what they want sooner or later. But whenever there's a something that's for the people, for the common man, something that primarily benefits just, you know, the average Joes, I guess you could say, the forgotten 330 million, it's interesting how quickly the pearls are clutched, you know, by Congress primarily, and how, I don't know, seemingly ignorant members of the executive branch become, and how quiet members of the judicial branch becomes in those moments. And suddenly it's, you know, well, we have to watch ourselves. You know, we have a fiduciary responsibility. You know, we have to be fiscally responsible and we have to count our pennies. And, you know, we have to look out for the John Q taxpayer. And, you know, all that stuff comes out, you know, whenever those things come around. One big example of that would have to be the wars, I guess if you can call them that, and some may call them proxy wars, but things that we witnessed during our 20-year stint in Afghanistan and our 20 years in Iraq, 20-plus years, and we're talking trillions and trillions of dollars that just did what exactly? One big item there is if you look at the situation, everything that happened in Afghanistan. I mean, 20 years of essential, I mean, you could just call it occupation, and $3.9 trillion funneled through there. And what happened? We're there because of the Taliban. And then look at that. We left and the Taliban are back. So we switched out the Taliban with the Taliban over the course of 20 years and trillions of dollars. And no one batted an eye. I mean, occasionally you get some of that political theater from Congress, which that's great and all. But still, I mean, all that money. And then when someone brings up, you know, hey, you know what? What about student loan forgiveness? You know, $1.7 trillion, you know, forgiving that, I think would really lighten the load, you know, and give the American people a bit of a break, the working class a bit of a break. Wait a minute, you know, I'm not, you know, I don't have loans. I'm not paying for someone else's this and that and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, the divisions are there, which some of them are legitimate. Some of them are manufactured. But it's still interesting, you know, $1.7 trillion, that would be a huge relief to a lot of working class citizens, a little extra coin in their pocket that maybe they could take a trip, maybe pay off the other, you know, $2, $3 trillion in credit card debt that's floating out there, and the almost $1 trillion debt in auto loans and all the other stuff. Maybe they could put it towards that. You know, that would be nice. And I see the other side of it too. Those that say, hey, wait a minute. Well, I'm not going to gain anything from this. So no, I don't want to bless off on this and have my tax dollars go towards paying off someone else's debts and loans. But it's all about the way you frame things. You know, you can get the American people behind a war slash occupation that could cost that, well, does cost trillions and trillions of dollars, something that could last for decades. And we'll get wrapped up in our emotions and we'll let our political officials just drive that train, that gravy train. And that's it. And we'll just occupy ourselves with whatever it is that we do to, you know, keep ourselves on autopilot for however many decades. And shrug our shoulders. And then something like this comes along, like, you know, paying off student loan debt or, you know, making a portion of medical insurance, you know, free or discounted or something like that. Well, wait a minute. Oh, my goodness. You know, and we lose ourselves. And, you know, of course, our politicians and the mainstream media, they play their part. Keep those divisions there. You know, keep us distracted, keep us running in the same direction, even if it's the wrong direction, even if it's a direction that only benefits a small fraction of the population. But no, just keep on running, keep going in that, you know, just dangle the keys here. Look at the keys, you know. And so when I hear people go back and forth, and I've said this about our political system, it's an absolute joke. When you really take the time to, it doesn't take much time at all, really, to step back and look at it, look at the three branches of government, look at all the committees and subcommittees in our legislative branch. When you look at the donations and how they just pour in every election cycle from the major corporations and how all that money touches, you know, both sides of the aisle, and you begin to just ask the obvious question, like, does this government represent me? You know, does my vote matter? You know, is anyone even listening to my input? You know, and these are the cries of over 300 million U.S. citizens, some voters and some aren't voters, because you have those that feel it's their obligation to vote. They have to, or I should say privilege, I guess. I wouldn't call it that, but it's a privilege. It's an opportunity to make your voice heard, you know, get out and vote and all that good stuff. And then you have another part of the population that has just completely given up and said, you know what, why bother? The other part of the population is just going to drag me right over the edge of the cliff anyway. So why don't I use this time to do something else? But anyway, it's hilarious. And then when you look at the executive branch, you know, who's going to be president, and I say, I who cares? I mean, really, in the grand scheme of things, who cares? Because when you look at the powers and the influence that the different branches have, I'm sorry, but no one really holds a candle to the legislative branch. I mean, the power that they have, and sure, as I stated before about all that big money that they call it lobbying, but it's really just legalized bribery. all that money flowing in, it creates an environment or a culture where you can almost predict that certain things are going to continue down a certain way, and we're going to continue down a certain type of path. Because the election cycles, they come around, and you need so much money in order to maintain your seat at the table that you have to indulge these individuals. You have to indulge the lobbyists, these representatives of the mega corporations and their needs in order to maintain your place of power. Even though, I mean, can you really call it power if someone else is just dictating you what to sign, what to turn into law, what to disregard, but, you know, whatever. But in order to hang on to that, you have to take that money. I mean, it's quite, I think it's interesting. I mean, it's sad, mostly sad, but it is interesting. And, you know, when you look at Congress, and sure, when you were in school, it's, hey, what does the executive branch do? Oh, well, they execute the laws, you know, that's their thing, you know, that's their focus. You know, the president uses his or her power. Well, I'll just say his power because we haven't had a female president yet, but we had a female vice president, or, well, I guess we still do for the moment. But he uses his power to take the laws that the legislative branch makes and enforces those laws and executes those laws, ensures that they're executed at the lower levels, you know, at the state level and so on. And then the judicial branch, you know, what do they do? Well, they evaluate, you know, they evaluate the laws. And when they see something that just stands out as unconstitutional, you know, then they step in and right the wrongs. That's what they do. But when you look at the money and the way things just keep playing out, it's like we're stuck in some sort of cycle. You know, we have these elections, everyone gets all excited, you know, blah, blah, blah. But the same key problems still persist. You know, and let's talk about Congress for a second. You know, so for those of you who don't know, and it's a shame that I have to explain it this way, but some of the surveys that I've read and studies that I've reviewed, there's a large portion of, well, voters too, and just American citizens in general that don't understand that the three branches of government, that don't understand the, you know, the purpose of Congress and how Congress is structured, the financial side of it, just some of the basic things. So, hey, here it is. So Congress. So it's made up of two pieces. You have the Senate, you have the House. And the Senate is roughly 100 senators. And then you have the House, 435 members. All right. So when a law is proposed, and to be clear, anyone can write up a bill in hopes of it becoming a law. I can write it. You can write it. Boeing can write it. Chase Bank can write it. And then it goes before a subcommittee. And Congress, they have a lot of subcommittees. I think it's over 70 subcommittees. And they review it. They can kill that bill right then and there. Or if they review it, maybe receive a little something. I don't know. You never know. I think that might be how it works. Possibly. Then it moves from that subcommittee, it moves forward, and then it goes on the floor, makes it down there. You know, it gets pitched, and then they vote on it, right? And then it still hasn't become a law yet. It has to go to the executive branch. It has to go to the president. The president can veto it. Hey, you know what? No, I don't like this. Veto, boom, kick it back to Congress. And that's it, right? Well, no, it's not, because the Congress, and this is why I think that they are the cornerstone of all this. That's where the real power lies. When you can create something, send it to the president can say absolutely not, no, and then kick it back, and then you can have another vote. And if you get two-thirds of your folks to say, nah, we want to make this happen, then you can override that. You can override that presidential veto, and it's a law. You know, so that's power. You know, and some of the other powers that Congress has that allegedly we gave to them and is outlined in the Constitution. So Congress, of course, they have the power to make laws. They have the power to declare war. That's a big one, right? So they have the power to impeach and try federal officers, to approve presidential appointments. Interesting. To approve treaties negotiated by the executive branch, to raise and provide public money and oversee its expenditure. And another big one, oversight and investigations. So that's the you know, the branches working together, each one kind of oversees the other. At least that's how it's meant to work. And I have to put that in quotes, how it's meant to work. But does it? I mean, we watch every year, we watch Congress, we watch members of the Senate, members of the House bicker over things while we're all the common citizens, as commoners, are standing around waiting for things to happen, things that deeply impact our lives. Things that, you know, could impact whether we can pay our bills or not, you know, whether we can go on a vacation, where we can spend time with our family, where we, you know, where we can just live, essentially. And we have to wait. I mean, we see that with the just with some of the budgets, with the federal budget. You know, we just can't seem to get that thing approved, you know, right at the start of the fiscal year. It's just, there just always seems to be something that comes up, and you'll have some of the crustiest, oldest, geriatric congressional members suddenly getting excited, saying they're representing their constituents and that their needs and the needs of their state. And, you know, and this particular sentence in here of this 5,000 page proposal, I don't like this, so I think we need to shoot the whole thing down and just grind everything to a halt. And that keeps happening. They still get paid, of course. You know, members of Congress, they still get their money. They still get their $175,000 to, what is it, $274,000 a year salary, you know, on top of, you know, the kickbacks we know they get from K Street and from the lobbyists and all that good stuff. You know, so they press on and we wait. You know, and there's a movement that's been just on and off as far as term limits. You know, that's what we need. We need term limits. And it'll be a topic of conversation and for a little while, and then it'll just die down and people will forget about it. You know, so that's something. But should we explore that? I mean, we've got, I think the median age for members of Congress is 60, 65 years old, roughly. I mean, they've got people retiring in their 90s. Every once in a great while, they'll have one of them that'll, you know, they'll retire on their 100th birthday after proudly serving their constituents for 60 years or 30 years, you know. And it's like, well, really? I mean, we really want people, you know, essentially turning this what I believe to be the most powerful branch of government into some sort of retirement home. Some retirement community or something. Like, they should just, you know, just remove it from DC and, you know, maybe put it in Florida, you know, put it close to Miami or something. It'll be better suited there. It can just be a nice little retirement community. Because that's what it looks like. And there are those that'll make the argument that, well, we can't put those term limits on there, you know, because we'll lose, you know, well, you might shake off some of the bad, but you also shake off a lot of the good. And they have a lot of experience. Well, all right, but just because they have that great deal of experience, you know, that doesn't really mean all that much if it doesn't equate to results. I mean, real, tangible results. Why aren't we going off of that? You know, what have they actually accomplished for their constituents? What have they actually accomplished for the states they represent? You know, not just hanging around, collecting money, collecting contributions from corporations, and just voting occasionally and getting excited whenever there's a bill that, you know, involves, you know, one of their donors or something like that. But that's just another one of those things, you know. Now, the concept of term limits that for members of Congress, it's been a thing. Sure. It was something that was a part of the Articles of Confederation and, you know, the 1700s and 1780s, I'm sorry, where they actually had term limits. And it's was a thing for a little while, you know, for some years. And then we got around the 1990s. And it's one of those things where our judicial branch took a look at it and declared that the practice was unconstitutional. And I believe this case was the U.S. Term Limits Inc. versus Thornton. And there was a vote, and 5-4. Hey, this is unconstitutional. We need to get rid of this. And that was the end of that. I mean, you know, little conversations here and there. But that was it. And you have people that, you know, there are ways you could work around that precedence that was set in the past, where you could serve for 3 years and, you know, transfer off to something and do something else or work in the private sector and then come back and just, you know, the revolving door in Washington, that's something that we've become used to or become accustomed to. Those of us that even pay attention at some of these individuals that are appointed, where they'll be a part of some financial subcommittee for armed forces or something. And then they'll bounce over to, they'll be an executive member on the board of Raytheon or something. And then they'll come back over to the government side and then they'll go back. You know, so we're not really supposed to question any of that, but it happens, you know, and so we have these individuals that are, they're just so old. I'm sorry. I'm getting up there too. I mean, I'm 41, but come on. I mean, we have these people, they're in these roles where they need to be forward thinking. How many 90-year-old, 100-year-old retired attorneys, retired financial officers that have worked in Congress 30, 40 years, how many of them could be forward-thinking, really? I mean, let's be real here. So why not? I mean, we've got limits when it comes to the executive branch. You've got limits there. Right? You can only serve 2 terms, right? So that's a total of 8 years that the American people have to deal with you before you can just be shuttled away and then the next individual can step up to the plate and see if they can serve the corporations better than the last person. But in Congress, they can just hang 30, 40, 50 years. You know, so anyway, I digress, you know. So what's the point of all this? So my point really is that I just believe the American people should should care a little bit more about how they're governed, you know, how their institutions are structured, how they're funded, how many people have their hands in the pot, so to speak, when it comes to the law, when it comes to the Constitution. Otherwise, I mean, what's the point? You know, why, you know, we hold these things in such high esteem, but we know so little about it, care so little about it. When it comes to the Constitution, you know, people, I'll see people, well, it's usually during an election cycle where people go on and on about, you know, their constitutional rights, their rights, their rights. And when you ask them some specificity and, you know, what exactly do you mean is usually when you'll discover that, okay, well, they don't really understand or have a full comprehension of the Constitution or the full comprehension of American history or the full comprehension of the political system, and how much of a joke it is. Because if they did have that understanding, if they did understand those specifics or the history of it or the financial side of it or the big money that's involved, then their frustrations would shift. Rather than going back and forth about, you know, Biden over Trump, you know, I think it should be, hey, what about those 535 people that are highly influenced by the bribers or the lobbyists and those special interests? You know, why is it that there's, you know, all these different committees and super PACs and all these different things that are focused on the real estate sector, the insurance sector, the pharmaceutical sector, the big tech sector? But when, what about just the commoners, just us normal folks? And we make up most of the country. Where is our lobby? Where, you know, where is our support line that's looking out for our best interests, the things that matter to us? You know, where is that at? That influence to push these 535 mostly geriatric stiffs, mostly career politicians, to push them to do their job, you know, when it's time to vote on a bill, when it's time to analyze something that's going to become law. So, yeah, I think we should care a little more. You know, and until we do, we're just going to keep twiddling our thumbs every couple of years and getting frustrated and worked up, and why are things this way? And, you know, when are we going to solve this crisis? And when are we going to fix our educational system? Why is our medical system, you know, such a train wreck? You know, why is our insurance, health insurance, why is that such a mess? Why is our financial system such a mess? Well, as it stands, I mean, it's kind of working as it should. I mean, it's, you know, a lot of the power, the influence, and the money is funneling up to a very small little section, and while the rest kind of just withers a bit. That's how it, I mean, it's my observation. It's my opinion. Let me make sure I always get that disclaimer. That's my personal opinion on the political system and financial system and educational system and medical system and insurance systems within the United States. So anywho, I know I've just been rambling on and on and on and on, but I think you'll get the gist of it. We're in kind of a rough spot, you know, and we put ourselves here, and we will stay here until we decide to take up that responsibility and actually try to make a change for the better. So with all that, thank you for listening in. You know, thank you for all your support and your feedback. It means so much to me. And I will step off for now, but we will talk again soon. Snail Nation out.